Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Hello, this is Captain Jack
Hill.
Midrack, where the Navy MilBlog community's top bloggers discuss the latest developments, long-term trends, and the way forward for the Navy Marine Corps team and all things maritime. And welcome everybody to episode 5 of Midraps. I want to thank everybody for listening in. And as usually, up there on the Blog Talk Radio page, you have a chat room for those who would like to weigh in with their ideas in the chat room as well. And Eagle One, he's riding herd on the chat room. So if you have some questions, you can throw them out there as well. I'm your host, Fibian, from the blog Commander Salamander. And we have our normal panel back together this week. Eagle One of Eagle Speak and Galran of Information and Dissemination. And our special guest this week, near the bottom of the hour, we're going to bring on board Mackenzie Eaglin. She is the Research Fellow for National Security at the Heritage Foundation. We're going to do our panel discussion this week a little different. The big news in military circles, regardless of where you go this week, is going to be the QDR, the Quadrennial Defense Review, for those who don't like the acronym. We could spend 3 hours a day, every day this week, going through bits and pieces of this, and I believe you can get it from my co-host's sites as well, but if you go over to my home blog, Commander Salamander, CDR, salamander.blogspot.com. You can find the pre-decisional draft in PDF form that leaked its way last week over at Small Wars Journal, I believe. But what we want to do here is we don't want to go through chapter and verse of the QDR. We want to talk about some of the naval issues that are going to come out in the process of the discussion of the QDR. And many of that is going to be political. Back on the 20th of January, I think we got a few indications and warning on what some of those touch points, one of those hard topics that are going to come up as we look at the QDR, look at its recommendations, look at where they see, where we are, where we need to go in the military, and how the Navy builds into that. On the 20th of January, the House Armed Services Committee, Sea Power and Expeditionary Forces Subcommittee, had a meeting. And we're going to use the questions that they had in the committee meeting as a basis for the panel discussion in the first half hour. Something else we're going to do a little different this week is we're going to take callers throughout the show. So if you were going to wait till the bottom of the hour, as usual, to call in, you can go ahead and call in earlier. I just ask that you give us a chance to set the scene and to keep your questions to the point as much as possible. And if you want to call in, our call-in number is 347-308-8397, and of course on the show page at Blog Talk Radio you can see that phone number as well, 347-308-8397. So go ahead and queue on up, and once again, if you're shy, go on the chat room on Blog Talk Radio and feed the questions to Eagle One and he'll bounce them back to us. As promised, we're going to do something a little different. The 20 January subcommittee meeting, the guests there were Dr. Eric Labs. He's from the Congressional Budget Office. You also had Ronald O'Rourke. He's from the Congressional Research Service. And Lauren Thompson from the Lexington Institute. They were answering the questions. In the passive-aggressive nature that I am, though, you're not going to hear them. What you're going to hear is we've stripped out the questions from the Congress folks that were sitting on the committee. And you're going to hear questions from the chairman. That's Representative Taylor, Democrat of Mississippi, Representative Langevin of Democrat of Rhode Island, Representative Pinegree, Democrat of Maine, Representative Forbes, Republican of Virginia, and a former Navy man of some renown for those that know him, Representative Massa, Democrat of New York. And they'll be asking those questions. Now, we'll start things off with something that's a little funny, but there's some serious points on it that when it comes off, I'm going to give Gallerin a chance to whack at this teed up ball. When a lot of people think of DC duty, they think it's dull, frustrating, and it generally it ages you early in life. And of course, that's true, it does. But as anything in life that's worthwhile, it's worth working for. And there comes a price with doing important work, and that's what they do in D.C. But you can at least halt the aging process and keep an even keel if you look for humor where you can find it. And I found a little nugget of humor. There were three of them. I don't know if we'll get time for the other two, but I wanted to bring to the front a great piece of humor. Now, you're going to hear two people here. You're going to hear Lauren Thompson, who, if you don't recognize his voice, that's okay, because you will recognize Representative Taylor, who has a glorious Mississippi accent. And that's where the other shipyard is located. And this all came about when, for lack of a better phrase, Mr. Thompson was having a flirtatious banter exchange with Representative Pinegree of Maine, which has Bath Iron Works, a lot of people's favorite shipyard. I'll leave commentary one way or another to other people. So here's a little bit of humor for you. And then when we're done, we're going to have Gallerin tell us what the serious part of this actually is. Here you go.
Is it out of the box to consider that perhaps the 3-1...
Oop, I hit the wrong button.
The Navy had its way. It sent all the surface combatants to Bath. But in the
we
current...
We appreciate you saying that.
Oh, well, that's what the Navy tells me.
I'm sure the chair would differ, but I appreciate
the,
that.
But, however...
Mr. Thompson, you...
I'm merely characterizing...
You are just way out of line.
We know Secretary Mavis would never let that happen, so...
As a matter of fact, he's been quite vocal on maintaining the industrial base, so you're right about that. But I think...
So, Gallerin, what do you think?
I think that Lauren Thompson is correct that the Navy would ship all of their service combatant construction to Bath if they could. Of course, they're not going to be able to do that. There's a lot of political... There's just a lot of political considerations there that would prevent that from happening. But they did ship all of the DDG-1000 construction there, so there's one example where they would prefer to do that. It goes to the heart of the problems that they're having building ships down in the Gulf Coast. Everybody has probably read about the LPD-17 problems, and it does extend into some of the surface combatant construction down there as well with the welds. Now, the issue is not bad welds. A lot of people think, bad welds. No, it's not. The issue is actually they come back a year and a half later and they say the welds aren't thick enough. And the reason that matters is because it has to do with the life cycle of the ships. The welding issue is not a big deal. They will just add more welding material to the welds and it will allow it to last through the life cycle. The bigger problem is, of course, the engines. The LPD-17s are so complicated, and we presume that whatever the next surface combatant will be similar, that they don't know how to change the oil in a diesel engine. You know, this virtual training is coming back to bite the Navy in the ass. There's a hundred different ways you can read this, but Warren Thompson is generally correct. The Navy would love to put all of their surface combatant construction in Maine because there appears to be a process, a methodology utilized at Bath Iron Works that is more effective for building better quality. A lot of people can tolerate the lack of or the higher cost of ships if you're getting good quality product. But right now in the Gulf Coast, they're suffering from higher costs, and oh, by the way, the quality is not as good. That's a bad recipe in the political world of shipbuilding.
Eagle One?
Yeah, this problem has been around forever. If you go back to the original Spruance-class destroyers, they came out and had problems with reduction gears and other things. You know, some of those just the first ships of any class are going to have issues. I'm not sure. I know, the engine problems, there's been a lot written about that. I'm not sure what the solution to that is, other than better training and whether they've got the right alignment. I mean, it sounds to me like there's some issues with some of the machining of the engines themselves. But this is not an uncommon problem in any new construction. The difficulty we have is that the limited dollars we have and the limited number of ships we have, it tends to focus our attention much more immediately on the need to get these ships up and ready as soon as we can.
I think Galvin brought up a good point as well. You see with LPD 17, and it wasn't just the first in class with the San Antonio. I think the shock trials on LPD 19 had some issues as well. But he brought up a good point that when you look at the LPD 17 program, when you look at what we're trying to do with LCS, there was a lot of cost savings in the schoolhouse. We're thinking you could do things virtually. You can do things with a CD-ROM. You can put, you know, Seaman Schmuckatelli in front of a computer, give him a DVD, and have him be able to maintain diesel engines without having that hands-on that we had. And I think, and I know that there's an investigation that Fleet Forces Command, specifically on the LPD-17 problem they're looking at. It'll be interesting to see what pushes out the other end with regard to looking at some of the, my least favorite word, transformational projects that they went through, whether it's time to have a second thought of that and kind of get back to the fundamentals and how we should be training sailors on simple things like maintaining a diesel engine.
This LPD-17 thing is, I mean, it gets away from the question that Lauren Thompson was talking about with the surface combatants, but this LPD-17 thing really stinks to high heaven, too, because when the press went in there, they go down and they're talking to the NAVSEA rep. It's got to be some captain or something that's down there, and some ships had already looked at the welds and said that they're fine, and now they're saying they're not. And there was only one person there. It was just the program manager for the LPD-17. Now, here we have, in front of Congress, no less, admirals and people, Allison Stiller is a great example. They talk about how they've been fixing these problems with shipbuilding and all of the different methodologies that they're using. They've got more people that they're dedicating. And then when they bring in the press, there's only one person, one, who's there besides the nice young lady who is taking notes. I mean, come on. You have got to be kidding me. Where was McCoy? Where's the leadership to step up and to take the responsibility and to outline what is going to be fixed? This just stinks. I mean, that's unbelievable to me.
Priorities and leadership. Here's now the next question that we have. I would love to answer it myself because this is one of my hobby horses. I know my co-hosts are familiar with my opinion on this, but we'll let Eagle One get a first swack at this little baby.
In a perfect world, it'd be nice to park a nuclear aircraft carrier anywhere. In a non-perfect world, does it make sense to spend almost as much money on creating a new nuclear-capable home port as it does building a nuclear-capable ship?
Eagle One, shoot. What they're talking about there is the issue with Mayport. Do we upgrade Mayport to get strategic fleet dispersal, or do we save that money and keep everything on the East Coast right there in Norfolk?
Yeah, you know, that's. I think that back in the layman days of as SecNav and his plan to move the fleet all over the map with the various home ports we spent God knows how much money on. We've already seen this, and somewhere along the lines, somebody's got to say, well, you know, how much harder, how much degree of difficulty do we add to somebody's targeting computer program if we move a ship to another port? And I just can't believe that it's worth the difference that it would make justifies the expense. One man's opinion.
Galvin?
I'll shoot off after you because I know this is a subject you love. Go ahead.
Yeah, first of all, I perfectly understand both Representative Massa, who's the one asked the question, point, and as well as yours, Eagle One. I kind of look at it from a different angle, though. What I look at it from is when I was a midshipman cruising around on a sailboat in the Chesapeake Bay one summer, I remember going by the piers at Norfolk. And this was back when we had fleet dispersal back in the 80s. And first thing that went through my mind is, as this big old Liberian Group 3 cruised by, I went, wow, you could really just take out what at that time was one quarter of the fleet. Just give me a couple of group threes and some people are willing to die, and boy, you could take them out for a few months, no problem. And you don't really need to think that hard about, you know, you're not going to sink the ships. But if you wanted to put a nick in things, it wouldn't be hard to do. And Admiral Harvey, Fleet Forces Command, I know got his toes stomped on for saying it, but he came out with a similar concept as well, that maybe it's not that bad of an idea to have more than one place to keep your nuclear carriers.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Admiral Harvey's. He's the only admiral who will put his opinion out in front and let everybody hit it. I think that he has demonstrated repeatedly that he is the premier leader with the stars on the shoulder in terms of out front leading people at Fleet Forces Command since he's arrived there, and even before, but since he's arrived there, it's been pretty obvious. I'm in agreement with you and Admiral Harvey. You have to think about these things. I don't know if it's worth the cost. As Eagle One points out, it's going to be very expensive. It really depends on how big we're going to make our nuclear force. Right now, the law on the books says we have to build every new surface combatant with nuclear power. Well, we're not going to build the Burks forever, and now we're not going to build the cruisers, according to the QDR. So my thinking is that what they're probably going to end up doing is consolidate to one platform, like what has been recommended by Bob Work, who's now undersecretary, for several years. And the question will that platform be nuclear powered? There's a good reason that it might be. And a lot of people say, well, the Navy doesn't want it. Yes, I understand the Navy doesn't want it, but there's still a really good reason that it might be. First, every time you start building nuclear power plants, it brings the total cost of nuclear power plants down considerably. You can bring the cost of a nuclear submarine down quite a bit by moving nuclear power to your surface fleet. A lot of people may not know that, but it has to do with the nuclear power infrastructure. And there is, at least according to the State of the Union address, some political support for building nuclear power plants in the United States. And by the way, even if they build a nuclear power plant in the United States, that helps bring down the cost of a nuclear-powered submarine. These issues are all tied together. People may not realize that, but it's the nuclear issue. The nuclear power issue is a big bundle, and the costs start coming down as we build more and more. So we'll see. If they are going to go with nuclear power in the surface combatants, it's a great idea. If they're not, I think that there's good arguments on both sides.
I'm gonna weigh in again if I can.
Please.
You know, we're talking about one coast. We've got another coast. We used to have ships unported in Oakland at Alameda, and we did away with that. Are we going to now set up another port? Are we going to split the fleet on the West Coast again as we did before, or are we going to consolidate our operations in one place and save the money for that? And you know, this also begs the question: if you are up on Captain Hughes and his piece on the new fighting Navy, whatever it's called, there's a suggestion of a lot of many smaller carriers, which I think would, you know, diversify the force at probably a great, much less expense than moving one of the big CVNs down to Jacksonville or back to San Francisco.
Yeah, I think the West Coast challenge folds in with the East Coast challenge as well. And, I think both sides of the argument have merit. And at least unfortunately for me, if I was to have to bet, I'd have to bet against myself because more money isn't going to show up. And when you talk about carriers and ships, I think you're talking about the sexy side of the shipbuilding challenge, so to speak. Next question I want to throw over to Eagle One, because if you talk about unsexy, I think the next one probably hits it.
And I was interested to just hear a statement. If we knew 10 years ago what we would know now, that we probably would have not purchased any DDG-1000s. And for the record, at least one member of this committee did, in fact, know 10 years ago what we know now. And in other capacities, was incredibly verbal in opposition to that ship class, an opposition I continue to be verbal on. We built two command ships based on a previous generation of amphibious hulls. Is it outside the box to consider using the LPD-17 platform to replace those two command ships?
Yeller.
Okay, so there's really two issues here. One is the DDG-1000. Should we even build the ones that we have? I think we should build at least two. Three would be great for the workload at Bath. I think the DDG-1000 is going to end up being a great ship for the Navy, but as a platform that we deploy, forward deploy and all of that, it's going to be, it'll stick around for 20 years before they're retired for budgetary reasons because they're just too expensive to maintain. But from a technology demonstrator perspective, a wonderful idea to build a few. They are going to pay off, I assure everybody, and in 10 years, I'm going to be playing that back and forth in front of everybody. The command ship issue is interesting. Leading into the QDR, they talked about two different possibilities. One would be canceling the command ships. The other would be delaying the command ships. Well, with the Gulf Coast having their shipbuilding problems, delaying the command ships seems like a no-brainer. That's probably the easiest thing they could have written into the QDR for the Navy. Yes, the LPD-17 is the platform you want. You like to build these things on amphibs. The LPD-17 also has the C-2 that you want. I think the command ships are going to be more important. I'll be surprised if we build only two because our strategy in the QDR as outlined and built on the maritime strategy itself is for partnerships, and you have to put all of these people someplace. And to put them all on the same ship would be a good idea because you can see the benefits when we have your command structures together in places like Bahrain where we have a lot of our command structure working for the pirates. Well, in that situation, there's assured access to your bandwidth. But in war, you're not going to have assured access to bandwidth, and you're going to want to have all of those command assets consolidated. So I think the command ships will ultimately be more important than just, we'll have two. I see them as potentially being a number of different things for your network in the future because of the way that they're looking at network battle space and things of that nature. But for the most part, the delay is a great idea. 10 years, let's give the Gulf Coast some time to get their procedures and their shipbuilding under control.
I'll tell you what, and when it comes to command ships, the French are building a pretty nice class of command ship right now, and I think you nailed it right there with the direction we're going through. I did a little word search on that draft QDR that was coming up, and if you just do a search on humanitarian disaster and assistance, you get 10 hits, and international cooperation as well. Command ship buys you a lot, and I think that's a conversation going forward on how we're going to do it as well. Eagle One.
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking about ways to save money, and I would probably not go with the LPD hull, but with merchant hulls that already exist. If it's a matter of a comms package and some other gear, I'd load it up that way. I just don't think we need to spend more money designing hulls that we from scratch. I think there already have enough assets out there. And, you could modularize, I love the word, LCS, modularize it and put some additional components on there. And you could do a lot of different things with a large merchant type hull.
Now, in the next question, I want to put at you, Eagle One, and this will probably be the last question we have before we go to our guest. And a lot of people talk about thinking about different ideas and different concepts. I'm not completely sold on it, but the idea of a radar picket might be worth a discussion.
My question is for the panel. With the possible deployment of anti-ship ballistic missiles, there's obviously a need for increased effectiveness of existing Aegis BMD ships and a new level of fleet protection. And I'm sure that you're aware that the capability of the Cobra Judy replacement ship. And I've been briefed on the augmentation of a platform like this with BMD capability can actually be used as a near-term, cost-effective naval adjunct sensor. So So can you speak to your assessment of this capability and how one or more of these ships could impact the number of BMD-capable cruisers and destroyers we might need for this mission?
Eagle One.
Wow. You know, those old radar pickets were pretty good at helping us detect the kamikazes before they got run into by the kamikazes themselves. You know, anything you put out there in front of the fleet to detect stuff is the first target if you're on the other side. You know, we have all these systems we've developed, these over the horizon radars and other things that ought to work without having assets with human beings on them that close to whatever detection range we need. I mean, I guess you could use some kind of UAV or whatever the surface equivalent of that is and put them out there and have them detect remotely. But you could put sea buoys out there for that matter.
Alan?
Yeah, I think it comes down to how you want to do ballistic missile defense. And I'm not convinced that the Navy really knows the long-term strategy yet or has decided the long-term strategy yet. The short-term strategy is going to be the Aegis system that we have that works, and they'll distribute that out across the Burke fleet, and that's a great baseline to start with. As most people know, the ballistic missile defense, the way it works is you have one ship as the radar and one ship as the shooter. I don't know. It's a lot of focus on sensors. I don't think sensors are a problem. We have a problem with bullets. There are just not enough missiles. The thing that I'll be looking for in the fiscal year 11 budget is how many SM-3s are going to be in the budget, because they need to build a bunch. They need to build a couple hundred this year starting, because they take about 3 years to build, to get built and fed into the fleet, distributed, and they also cost money to maintain, but you have to build those bullets, and we don't have bullets. We have sensors. We have, I think, 21 now. Will be up to 27 by fiscal year 13 or something like that is the current plan. They may increase that with the QDR, suggesting up to 32. I hear rumors that there's actually a push for more, faster, but you're talking about sensors, and that Cobra Duty is just another sensor. We have plenty of sensors. We need bullets, so that's my take on it. I think one of the things that Congress is doing is they're missing the point if they think that this is a sensor problem, because I don't think we have a sensor problem so much, because the Navy has really taken that challenge on. We have a bullets problem, and who's going to pay for the bullets is a question.
I think you hit a real good point, because oftentimes it's not who has the most guns that wins it, but who has the most ammunition. And I'm sure the Aegis Mafia guys could talk to us till our ears bleed. Shoot, shoot, look, shoot, look, shoot. Are you going to cross-deck your missiles from one ship to another? We know what an evolution and a challenge that can be. If you have X number of platforms and Y number of VLS cells, that equals Z number of missiles. And, of course, you have other ones that are going to need service. And that, you're right, that's a lot of numbers. And I think we both posted back at the end of last year some of the higher brain function work that had actually been played out based upon the different blocks of missiles that are due to come online in the next decade, of where you'd have to station, how many ships it would take to do it, and you're talking about a lot of missiles. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, I agree. One of the things that you hear different companies talk about what ballistic missile defense would be in the future, and with the cruiser, they thought, well, that would be your sensor, and then you could have a bunch of even LCS-sized little frigates running around with VLS able to shoot, and you could disconnect the radar from the shooter. I don't know that it matters as long as you have VLS. You can have your VLS be partnership countries. It could be Spain or the Dutch or the Japanese or whoever has VLS can shoot the SM-3. The key is to make sure that you, as long as you have the radar capacity, which we really do have. I mean, Cobra Duty's the replacement would be great as an extra sensor, but aren't we putting land-based radars in Japan? Aren't we We've even discussed putting them in Taiwan, which was not very politically popular. I mean, the number of sensors out there exceed the number of ships by far, and they're talking about putting that ability on the Hawkeye. So you plug this in, will there be enough bandwidth is a better question. I think Congress is missing the point when they talk about sensors, because there's other pieces to the network that makes it work that we really need to be focused on. It, bullets is one of them. Bandwidth. I mean, that, you talk about words that are missing in the QDR. There's one. That was a stressed point in the 2006 QDR. It didn't even show up, but yet we talk about all these networks. Bandwidth, bandwidth, bandwidth. I mean, that's the key to making something like air-sea battle work. I'll get off my pony now.
Well, you know, you talk about conversations, and it'll make your ear bleed. If anybody ever wanted to talk about bandwidth and EHF and UHF satellite bandwidth and narrow beams and all that good stuff, you hit on a very good point. It's all fine on a PowerPoint, but when you actually have to push lots of ones and zeros in a very robust manner that with very little error rate, you've got a big problem. I want to remind everybody who is listening, again, this is Midrats, Amphibian Salamander of the blog Commander Salamander, and our co-hosts today are Eagle One of Eagle Speak and Galran of Information Dissemination. Our number, if you want to call in with questions, is 347-308-8397. And it's time to introduce our guest at the bottom of the hour. So our guest is Ms. Mackenzie Eaglin. She's the Research Fellow for National Security Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Just a quick CV I'll give for you on her. It seems like every episode of Midrats, we have to have somebody connected to Maine. We have that again today. In her past, she has been a senior defense advisor to Susan Collins of Maine, and she's diversified a little bit out of Maine. She was also a legislative assistant to John E. Sweeney, a representative from New York. She's been published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Military Times series of publications, and other national security papers, magazines. Many papers published, studied up at Carlisle. And she was also the assigned to the Pentagon as a Presidential Management Fellow and wrote speeches for former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard B. Myers. So, Mackenzie, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks for having me. I was glad to hear my intro wasn't, if you really want your ears to bleed, let's talk to Mackenzie.
Well, next time you come on, we'll hit you a little harder. When I first found out about an opportunity to bring you on board, and again, thank you very much for coming on board to kind of give us all an opportunity to discuss the QDR earlier than we're supposed to, but that's okay. When I saw that you were from the Heritage Foundation, my head tilted a little bit, because I think when most people think of the Heritage Foundation, they think of economic issues, maybe domestic policy issues. Tell us a little bit about what you do in the national security arena at the Heritage Foundation, and in a broader sense, what the Heritage Foundation is doing in the national security arena.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me. I really do feel like I'm in the presence of giants. I've learned a lot listening to all three of you and admire you very much, all of you. You know, Heritage is, you're right, known primarily for domestic policy issues, but we're about half and half foreign policy, domestic policy focus. We're the largest think tank in the country, one of the largest, I think, in the world. We're the most broadly supported public policy institute. We're not Democrat or Republican. We're nonpartisan, but we are conservative. And, so we believe in, you know, conservative principles as the foundation for any of our analysis. We have about 600,000 members, kind of like the Obama campaign, where checks under $1,000 primarily. Don't have major endowments, don't take major contract money, definitely no government funds. We've been around since the early 70s and have an operating budget of $60 million a year. Our defense team is pretty robust, I think, although we certainly can never cover all the issues. And again, we examine everything from regional to functional department-wide and interagency issues on anything you can think of.
Great. And was there anything in the last half hour that we were discussing when you're looking at the QDR and coming forward that you saw really as a primary issue on it from a Navy point of view that you hear being discussed inside the Beltway?
Well, I do want to, of course, give Gollering kudos because he's right, absolutely right about two points. The Navy doesn't have a long-term strategy for ballistic missile defense yet, and in part I think that's because the department writ large lacks that strategy. And SM-3 is put your money where your mouth is, where everything's going to be at in 2011. And, you know, the QDR, as you know, we see these every 4 years, and they really can be pivotal documents in some ways. In other ways, they're, you know, for practical utility, they're often shelved immediately. It just depends on what you're using it for. But, you know, in large part, this strategy is, it's a justification of the 2010 president's budget request, not even the one coming over tomorrow for 2011. And we all know last year's budget request was an extension of the National Defense Strategy. I mean, I haven't seen a lot new here for the Navy. A lot of the recommendations were in the operational weeds, so to speak. You know, a couple helos here and a new JSTARS there and a couple additional F-18s. But, I mean, this wasn't sort of a wide-ranging next-generation look, which by law the QDR is supposed to do. It was obviously very heavily focused on the present. So, if you look at today and what the Navy is doing, and I think this is implicit in some of the remarks you were making earlier, it's just a linear, you know, projection forward. It's a status quo.
Yeah, there was nothing there that really caused me to back up and go, whoa, look at that. Gowron, did you have a question for McKinsey?
Yeah, I was going to ask if you see anything in this QDR that says, yeah, this is going to be influential. Usually, like you said, a QDR is used for justification or ignored depending upon somebody's agenda. And a lot of people are talking about the QDR's release, yippee, you know, hooray. What is influential here if there's no statutory aspect to the QDR? I mean, there's no statutory requirements that actually get directed. It's just, do we just go back and look at the budget and see what's coming, or how do we look at this?
Well, it's a great point. I mean, having followed defense policy and worked for, of course, these policymakers for 12 years now, the QDR, here's what's funny. It's not going to answer any of the questions that every DOD, you know, testifier gave before posture hearings last year. Remember, every difficult question was, well, we'll tell you the answer in the QDR. It isn't even going to come close to answering all the questions. And as far as looking forward, like I said, it is not a visionary document by any means, and it's certainly not strategic in that it focuses on the out years, the 10 to 15 years from now where we want to be. It's really just a projection forward of our legacy fleets in many ways. But, yes, when it comes to actual what to take note of in this strategy, my answer is the 2011 budget and, to a smaller extent, the FYDP, which we didn't have last year along with the 30-year shipbuilding plan. But it's all about where are the dollars and where are the planned dollars. And for questions like, you know, ballistic missile defense, the future of the new third site, for example, and everything else that's going to matter to the Navy, for me, the answers are in the 2011 budget. They're not in this document.
Eagle One.
Yeah, I had a chance, McKenzie, to go back and look at one of your October articles about the one of the failings of the QDR, which seems to be that the new one focuses on a one war construct, and you argued in favor of the QDR focusing on a two war construct. Could you go through that a little bit?
Sure. Well, we started the QDR process, you know, Congress started it in the late 90s, and ever since, for the last 15 years, give or take, you know, the department has sized and shaped the forces and all the military departments around the ability to be able to fight and win, you know, two major theater wars, you know, give or take roughly at the same time, overlapping nearly simultaneously, et cetera. And, you know, this QDR makes a big, you know, splash, or it thinks it does, by dropping the two major theater war construct and saying it's the world's too complicated and the threats are too unknown, so we're just going to basically need to just do everything. All the last QDRs didn't do what I call the kitchen sink, told the military to do everything. And, you know, every QDR since its inception has basically added missions to the Department of Defense, and by extension, you know, just reality, i.e. the 90s and then, of course, post-9/11, But yet we've consistently been paring back overall force structure in terms of quantitative in general for the department. And this QDR is not going to take us down any different track. My concern about dropping the 2MTW construct, the long-held construct, is that there will – this is one area, back to Gawron's question, where there could potentially be a gasp, but it won't be felt for 5 years, because this is something that everybody knew and understood. And this new muddied kitchen sink approach, where we're definitely taking it off the table, and if you look at the set of scenarios this QDR plans for, the only real major contingency it ever calls for is a medium-sized contingency. Well, I would call, elements of Iraqi freedom a medium-sized contingency, particularly up front. Even Afghanistan at certain points, taking things like Desert Storm as a major operation, as a yard, just to give people vague references, being able to do one medium contingency really truly sets the U.S. back, and it will further – what it will seek to do is in the future it allows an administration to cut force structure and justify it based on what this strategy says we need to do, and that's what concerns me.
Now, Mackenzie, the point you just brought up reminded me of something with the dangers when you come out and you build things about one medium conflict. Because you remember, especially in the build-up to 2003, in the invasion of Iraq, there was a lot of concern. It's like, well, we've got a little bit of stuff going on in Afghanistan, and now we're throwing so much that we have available in Iraq. Boy, that sure opens the door for another player to do something aggressive in a military manner, because we just don't have the capability to respond to anything else. And I think that would definitely open the door when you have force structure brought down to a certain level, that when you reach a situation where nations find themselves where they have to commit their forces, when you do that, you've pretty much announced, we're tapped out, we're Winchester.
I couldn't agree more. You know, the only real place in this QDR looks forward into the future in any high-end conflict is what, the anti-access section, which of course would heavily rely on Navy capabilities to respond. And it seems like any of the new major next-generation high-end conflict capabilities will come at all, if at all, in a follow-on study for power projection. Well, all of us know the outcome of studies in the department. They never recommend more force structure, and it's really just a kick-the-can-down-the-road kind of approach to answering difficult questions. But the problem is that with QDR starting behind the curve for exactly what you said, where we are today, the U.S. never really possessed the capability to conduct two high-end overlapping conflicts in the first place. We can do what we can do today, which is two medium-range contingencies overlapping today. But to then project forward and say, well, we might need all of this for an anti-access scenario, but yet propose not really investing in the capabilities required to do that, you're not only starting behind the curve, it further sets us back when we know the procurement cycles for next generation systems of about a decade.
And we have a caller. Gawron, do you have a follow on before we go to the caller?
Yeah, I was going to ask, you had previously written a suggestion, I guess it was early in 2008, right when the QDR process started, to create an independent panel that would review the findings of the QDR. And Congress seemed to like that idea, and they created a panel similar to what you had recommended, but they allowed Gates to appoint, I guess, the lead, and it's a bipartisan panel and all of that. Do you still see that need, and can you kind of outline what that recommendation was, what you have expectations of this panel doing?
Sure. Yes, the Congress ultimately came up with a hybrid panel. It's known as an independent panel, and basically it's designed to offer a critique of the QDR and take an outside look, meaning people who are not on a .gov email or a government payroll or at an FFRDC, and allow true independent outsiders to examine the QDR and all of the scenarios and even classified material that goes into feeding into this very short document. We all know there's thousands of supporting pages here. And to go through all that data and decide what are the gaps in what they recommend, what are the gaps in what the law demands the QDR do in general, which there are many, as I've already outlined, and offer that report to Congress as an alternative assessment. I see its importance as even more than a year ago when I was recommending this legislation, because there really hasn't been a rigorous defense debate about the future. Because the president maintained a holdover Secretary of Defense who based all of his major programmatic decisions last year on an NDS issued in a previous administration based on foreign policy guidance of the last president, the department and its decisions and congressional buy-in has been on autopilot. So this is really the only time we're going to see a fair, full, and open debate on this president's defense priorities, which is really, you know, of course, the secretary's. And they're ripe for critique and questioning because so much is being done, so many decisions are being made that are permanent and irreversible in the department right now, and they're being done in a blink and without any debate because there are so many happening at once, everything from major programs to things like the shift in the third site to things on the ground in current operations. It's high time for an independent look at this, and like I said, a wide open debate that includes people outside the department who are not subject to non-disclosures and all the other requisites therein.
Absolutely, because you're exactly right, Mackenzie. They are flooding the zone right now with changes. And something that we talked about before we went on the air between the panel is the tapes, the recorded clips. I'll come into the 21st century and call it recorded clips. That came from that subcommittee meeting. Three out of the four people there really could not speak their mind out front, you know, from the Congressional Budget Office and the Congressional Research Service. They were quite limited in doing that. What I'd like to do at this point is give everybody a reminder that you're listening to MidRats, and in addition to our normal panel, we have as our guest Mackenzie Eaglin, the fellow on National Security Studies at the Heritage Foundation, and we have a caller on the line, area code 904. Do you have a question for Mackenzie?
Are you going to be seeing a lot of? You think we'll be seeing a lot of early DCOMs shrinking of the current fleet?
Okay, early DCOMs.
Yes, thank you. I'm getting used to this new format, so excuse me if I'm cutting you off. Well, we've been seeing that for the past couple of years, particularly for the Navy and the Air Force, because there isn't enough funding for maintenance. Everybody wants to extend the service life and keep, you know, ships in the fleet longer. I'm a big proponent of that. It's a lot more inexpensive than building, you know, new ships, and the Navy can get more bang for its buck. But let's be honest, the SCN account is just too small for everything the nation's asking the Navy to do. I do think we'll see a reprieve from the mass retirement DCOM, however you classify it, whether it's ships or aircraft, in 2011, but not necessarily over the five-year Pentagon budget, which is concerning. But I think that the leadership understands and recognizes what they can get for, you know, for a few investment dollars up front in the Navy force structure in particular this year. So thankfully we'll see a slowdown, but I don't know how long it'll last.
Well, that leads me to my second point. A lot of this deferred repair work is ending up costing the Navy a hell of a lot more money. Part of my job is to go out and conduct inspections for my company to write up reports. And then comes the negotiating part. And the government says, well, we don't want to do this, we don't want to do that, but we need to do this. And I tell them, look, if you do this now, while we're all set up on the job, you're going to drop automatically 40% of the cost of doing it. If we come back in 6 months and do it, you're going to tack that 40% back onto it. Do you understand what I'm saying? Yeah, I know, but we don't care. And in 4 months, we're back because now instead of being a thin deck, you got a hole in the deck and water's coming through it. I see it day in and day out. But yet they turn right around and do silly stuff like replace doors that work perfectly fine and all they need is adjusting. I mean, there's no sense, rhyme, or reason to it.
You know, I think one of the things he's hitting on, Mackenzie, is there was a little bit of discussion in late last year about focusing a bit more as the realization of, occasionally I derisively call it the Tiffany Navy, that if you only have a fixed budget and each hull costs a lot, you're not going to get many ships. So Back to the Future, try to bleed that out a bit, whether they're really putting enough money forward to be able to back up on the waterfront what they would like to do on extending ship life inside the budget.
Well, I think that the real answer is very difficult to grapple with, which is, you know, a fixed top line and how truly tight money is within the department and how much the Navy and the Air Force have taken a hit as bill payers for the Army since 9/11, because you've generally had people, it's hard to explain to people who aren't like all of us listening and talking today because we follow defense issues, but to the American people, you know, they see since 9/11 defense budgets have risen. Well, yeah, but we've also been obviously heavily engaged in Iraq and Afghanistan, coming off an entire decade of underinvestment called the 1990s of the procurement holiday and cutting the force by one-third. So we went into 9/11 with a force inadequately sized to do everything we're asking it to do in this decade and the next one. So then you take that and you add to it, you know, growing top lines. But when you look at the core defense budget, which funds the peacetime military, the military also for the future, your current military is, you know, primarily funded in supplemental spending, and what you have is a fiscal situation that's just not pretty, and the Navy has felt this just as much as the Air Force, and it really, there are no good answers except that there should be more leadership from the Navy. I've not seen a CNO come out in the last 3 years and advocate for a higher top line, for example, for the service, for to meet whatever these priorities are there, including maintenance and extending service life, et cetera, fixing the fighter gap, whatever the issues are. Instead, they're just taking it, and I think real leadership demands you sometimes say what's politically inconvenient or difficult, and we haven't really seen that.
Exactly. Very good point. Eagle One, did you have something for?
Yeah, I've got a quote here I'm going to start off with from Anthony Cordesman and Fitzgerald from their 2010 Quadrennial Defense Review. This is a quote. Like all the other services, the Navy showed a critical lack of top-level leadership. Did not include a 30-year shipbuilding plan, which outlines its long-term plans in its fiscal year 2010 budget request, stating it would wait until after the QDR is complete. Without defined future force plans or procurement goals, it is clear that several issues that need to be addressed in the upcoming review, including the future of amphibious landing capabilities, the role of naval unmanned combat aerial vehicles, and the overall mix between ships designed for littoral environments and the blue water surface combatants, are not being addressed. And along with that, let me add, there's a question here from Saturn V who asks about the effect of the QDR on the Navy's cooperative strategy for the 21st century sea power. Now, would you care to comment on that, McKenzie?
I would like to comment in general about, you know, where this QDR is falling short. And in fact, the purpose of the QDR is prepare for future likely conflicts. That's what's in the law. I'm speaking broadly here, of course. And this QDR pretends that the role of the QDR is to provide for a four-second fight today's conflicts, and the purpose is the opposite. And this affects all of these things you just raised. And I'm familiar with Dr. Cordesman's interesting insights, and he's often right about a lot of his criticisms of the QDR. What happens is it leads to things like outcomes that we saw in this document and which we'll probably see in the budget request as well, whether it's 2011 or over the five-year plan. But then you perpetuate certain myths there, you know, when you start from that as your assumption. You pretend that the legacy systems that we have are adequate, not because they are, but because the authors of the document possibly never intend to build, you know, robust numbers of new generation platforms. It pretends that legacy systems can be sustained at less than their actual cost because the real funds won't be there when we need them for things like maintenance. And it focuses on the treat, for example, riverine squadrons that the Navy should have because it can't justify its view of the force, just dropping the two major theater war constructs.
Gowron?
Yeah, I got about 15 things flying through my head after that comment. You touched on riverine. I'm looking at the force structure numbers for the Navy in the QDR, and it looks like they have basically taken, for example, 88 cruisers and destroyers. Well, if you count the one DDG-51 funded last year, that would create 88, basically 85 Aegis plus three DDG-1000s. and you look at the numbers for the smaller combatants, and that almost imitates the number of frigates that are there. Is the current force structure sufficient to go forward? Because that's kind of what the QDR implies. Or did the QDR miss on this? Just trying to get your take on that.
Sure. I think we're starting behind the eight ball, because that's basically what this QDR does, is it restates current force structure. There's nothing novel or visionary about it. And like I said, it basically linearly projects that forward. You know, 88 surface combatants, my God, that's the 313 ship fleet plan already. What is new about this force structure? But yes, given the additional requirements it's adding on to the department, you guys were referencing, for example, the multitude of humanitarian assistance, building partnership capacity, forward presence, a lot of the things the military is doing now, but even in greater numbers. You know, basically what this QDR says to me is, we're going to do the major operations we've been doing since 9/11, plus all the small-scale contingencies we did in the 90s, all at the same time. That's kind of where this QDR is heading. And it's saying legacy, current force, when I say legacy, I mean the stuff on the books today, current force structure will carry that out, you know, adequately. And I think your premise is exactly correct. Current force structure isn't even enough to do what we wanted to do today, much less tacking on 1990s-like missions, because, again, we started 2001 with a force one-third smaller than it was at the end of the Cold War, and that alone wasn't big enough to do Iraq and Afghanistan, much less everything else.
You know, McKenzie, you brought up a point earlier. I tapped into my inner Asperger's syndrome and did the little word count on that pre-decisional draft, because words mean things and they often advertise what you're emphasizing. And the comment you said that this really isn't what we've seen at this point, at least, isn't really answering the mail on looking forward, because when you look at how many times it mentions Iraq 55 times, it mentions Afghanistan 60 times. I guess, you know, that's the war we're at. That's kind of expected. But what you don't see, Somalia, Yemen, or Sudan, Somalia and Yemen, not once. Sudan is mentioned once. China, 10. Russia, 4. Iran, 5. North Korea, 3. And some of our best allies, Japan, only gets a mention of 4. The United Kingdom only gets mentioned once. Even Europe versus Asia, they only talk about Europe 11, Asia, all Eurasia 16 times. But where do you see us being able to take the argument forward in the 2 minutes we have left here to try to bring this discussion looking towards the future?
Well, this QDR is basically recommending a bunch of non-answer, lofty recommendations when it comes to the future. It's really leaving it all very open-ended, which for me means you're opening yourself up for more cuts in force structure, because that's what happens to QDRs. This QDR leaves our security largely in the hands of others by assuring the readers that agreements that may or may not come to fruition after review and dialogue. It says DOD will deepen relationships with other nations and private firms to, you know, work in space capabilities. We're not going to build it ourselves, but we're going to convince others to share their stuff. That's a wing and a prayer strategy. Then the DOD, another where's the beef kind of recommendation, it says the U.S. and partners will consult on policies that can deter aggression under new circumstances. So we're going to face down high-end adversaries with diplomacy, treaties, agreements, and building partnership capacity. But back to Gawron's point, the anti-access threat exists today, and our force structure is already inadequate. So it's not answering these questions, and it's pinning our hopes on our friends and allies, which we're definitely marginalizing in the document, which is the greatest irony.
And I think you may have just hit on the tagline for the response to the QDR that parallels the pre-decisional draft that we had to look at. Where's the beef? And the 1 minute we have left, first of all, McKenzie Eaglin from the Heritage Foundation, wanted to thank you very much for coming on for a guest. And if you feel like we treated you all right, I think sometimes down the road, if we have a chance, maybe we could bring you on again.
Please. It's my pleasure and honor, so thank you.
Excellent. And a quick reminder there for everybody, this Wednesday we're going to have a special on MIDRATS on Wednesday at 1700 Pacific Standard Time for Byron and Mayport. That would be 8 o'clock at night. We're going to have as our special guest the publisher of the United States Naval Institute, William N. Miller. The topic will be the Navy Media Ecosystem, and we will be doing it live from the 2010 West Conference and Exposition in San Diego. Thank you very much for the listeners and those on the website, and we'll see you Wednesday and next Sunday as well. Thank you very much.